Welcome to Chris. My name is Chris, and this episode we're going to be talking about Lord of the Flies, the book, not the movie, though the movie is great. And Lord of the Flies is something that I never read in high school. I know a lot of people do read it in high school, and I remember posting that I was reading it on Twitter, and a lot of people are just like, oh, I never want to read that book again. Oh, we had to read that in high school, and it was such a drag. And I never had that experience with it, so didn't really have that baggage coming in. Like, my high school, I was in AP English, right? Because I loved reading back then. I loved poetry and literature and was a pretentious person back then as well. But in my AP English class, I don't even think we read anything close. We read, like, Dante's Inferno. And we're supposed to do Crime and Punishment, but the teacher just had us watch the movie for Crime and Punishment instead. And I don't even remember what else was in the class. Mrs. Crawford did not give a single fuck about teaching us. She just liked to gossip, which was kind of disappointing. But in college, Lord of the Flies never came up. So I always had the sense that Lord of the Flies was a bit more childish. Like, not Harry Potter childish, right? But maybe somewhere between like Lord of the Rings and Stephen King in terms of being very endearing as a story, but the writing quality not being like up in the pretentious levels of literature, right? You're not going to be comparing the writing to William Faulkner. Like, I don't think anybody reads Stephen King and is like, he is a literary genius, like, that can rival Hemingway. He's a great storyteller, comes up with great stories, and the writing is solid, but there's just that difference, and I don't think that that's a bad thing, right? You need all types of engaging writing, but I'm pretentious. So I tend to read, like, literature and get really excited about literature. So I avoided Lord of the Rings, thinking lesser of it. And I knew the general plot, right? These kids are stuck on an island, and some go bad, some go good, and they kind of are really feral. That's all that I knew, so I avoided it. And then I finally picked it up. I read just the first few lines, and they low-key blew my mind. And I'll go through why. We're going to get a reading session with me right now. Let me get to the start of this. Okay, and you can see, God, I actually started to edit. Like, I started editing inline Golding. If you're listening to this on the podcast, I held the book up to the camera, but I had a pen and was crossing things out, writing in the words I would use. Pretentious. I'll say it so many times in this episode. Very pretentious. But okay, so the first line of Lord of the Flies: the boy with fair hair lowered himself down the last few feet of rock and began to pick his way toward the lagoon. Chris, what's so amazing about that line? I'm glad you asked. So the thing that I find compelling about this, and that straight from the get-go, I'm like, oh, Golding's got it. Like, this is going to be good. This is somebody that just, he's a writer. Again, pretentious. Literature. But you start with the flow of images is the thing that jumps out to me here, and, you know, nerdy writer talk, but it's the flow of images and the fact that we end with lagoon and everything that lagoon implies with it. So you get the first image of the boy with fair hair. And that might seem like, why is that a big deal? It just gives us a character to start with. But also, so many of the kids on the island end up becoming archetypes or abstracts based on their characteristics or one aspect of their personality. So to have him described as the boy with the fair hair, I think it already sets up this attitude of definition based on physical features or based on what people judge you by. And just having that little moment up front, I think, is very well done, and one of those things that you may not think about when you first start writing, the unity from the very beginning of how you're describing people that fits in with the larger aspect of how you're describing people. And it may not seem like it's that necessary at the beginning, but these first few lines, the first paragraph, the first page, really brings people into the world. So you want to load it up front with all the necessary subtext or subtleties needed to just bring the reader into the world and into the thematics of it as soon as possible. So even those first four, five words has something special to it. And then you have the boy with the fair hair lowered himself down. So you get the boy, then you get the action of him lowering himself down, and then the last few feet of the rock. So three images kind of going along. The boy lowering, the rock appears, which gives you a better idea of what he's doing, where he's doing it from, and began to pick his way. So now he's walking along toward the lagoon. And a lagoon isn't something most of us have in our day-to-day life, right? I'm never like, hey, we just went to the lagoon today. I don't think it's a word that comes up a lot. So the fact that you even have this kid being around a lagoon seems a little strange. So rocks, path, lagoon, it's out of the normal situation that you'd imagine a kid being in. But you might think, okay, he's just at play in the woods, something like that. But again, the stacking of images and the flow of the character from just the initial image of the boy, his actions of lowering himself, the rock, walking, and arriving at the lagoon, and the image that bursts when you get the word lagoon, that's just really well done and really strong writing to be able to string those things together like that. So I nerd out about it. And then the second line, though he had taken off his school sweater and trailed it now from one hand, his gray shirt stuck to him and his hair was plastered to his forehead. Great imagery again of the sweater dragging along the ground, the sweaty undershirt, the hair plastered to the head. It gives you a sense of heat and he's a bit bedraggled. And that's a cool thing too, the contrast that goes between the two clauses, right? Though he had taken off his school sweater and trailed it now from one hand is the first clause. Then you get the comma. His gray shirt stuck to him and his hair was plastered to his forehead. That's the second part. So in the first part, the school sweater has a charge of properness to it. It's part of a uniform. Kids in uniforms tend to be really put together. They tend to be in a place that expects them to conform to an idea of popular presentation or a standard of presentation. So the fact that this kid not only has the shirt off, but is dragging it on the ground is a escalating detail that, whether we know it or not, tells us that this kid's in a situation that probably isn't normal. That the togetherness or the put-togetherness, the appearance that he typically has been thrown out the window. Which, again, when we look at the novel as a whole, this one little detail gets at the whole concept of society being tossed aside and the more natural aspects of our being, physically, emotionally, existentially, being brought to the forefront. So the sweater drags on the ground because it's not really necessary anymore. And then you have just the kid in his sweaty undershirt with the hair plastered to his forehead. He's disheveled. It says so much again in just a line. And both of those lines escalate, right? In the first one with the kid just climbing down the rocks, that doesn't really tell us anything about what's going on. There's not a positive or negative charge about it. He could just be in his backyard near his house and everything could be fine. Or he could be running from a monster. Something horrible could have happened. We don't really know. So it's that next line that gives us that next detail that, okay, something isn't right here. And then we get to the third line. All round him, the long scar smashed into the jungle was a bath of heat. What? All round him, the long scar smashed into the jungle was a bath of heat. So yeah, that's the third point then that really tells us that something has just happened. And the fact that you're using the long scar, that might leave people a little confused. What's that mean? I don't know. It gets the people going though, right? It it's a long scar in the jungle. So the jungle that should be there has been ripped away, and you have this scar that's there. But the bath of heat, which is such a great phrase, implies that there's an immediacy to the action, that the thing has just happened, and this kid is there for it in the aftermath of whatever it is. And then the last line of the paragraph, I'll read it. I don't think it's that as compelling as the first. He was clamoring heavily among the creepers and broken trunks when a bird, a vision of red and yellow, flashed upwards with a witch-like cry, and this cry was echoed by another. "Hi," it said. "Wait a minute." Not as compelling of information, but a transition of still the him clamoring this jungle, this bird that's exotic, and then the transition to the conversation with other kids and the appearance of other kids that then follows this. But right up front, having that degree of nuance to those first few lines, that command and control, being able to represent so much of what the novel is going to be about in a few innocuous lines, incredible, powerful. Like, that is literature. So it was at that moment that I was just like, oh shit, okay, Golding has it. Like, this is going to be some great writing. And it was. Throughout the book, there were incredible amount of moments that I was just nerding out over the use of language. On top of that, the characterization really is fantastic. And probably the thing that people remember the most from the book is just how defined protagonist and antagonist are, and how well Golding develops the insanity between the groups. That it starts with communal respectability for one another before descending into politics and that fracturing and escalation then of individual attitudes and spirits until we get just horrendous archetypes at the very end, escalating to those moments where these kids embody good and evil, the hunter and the prey. It's amazing where we go. And I didn't expect that either. Like, I thought the kids were going to be in some bad situations. I just didn't think they were going to be in such fucked up situations, like murdering each other, thinking that one kid's a pig and just delighting in killing him. It had some really fucked up scenes. But I think the moment I fell in love with the book was the parachuter scene, when that dude descends and lands, and we just get that image of his body there and the parachute going, and it creates the myth of the monster as the kids come upon him and see in, I think it's the dusk, this body there and what it looks like. Awesome. And it's not just the scenario. I tend to really like things that have monsters in them, but it's the gothic nature to the language, the poetry of that moment, how Golding really builds it up and gives it this heft through the language and through the description that makes it all the more terrifying when the kids come upon it, when the kids see it, find it. And then you get everything that follows, all the politics and escalation was enjoyable to me, but I was really just in it for Simon's descent into madness at that point. Like, Ralph and Jack were both annoying, right? Ralph because he was so sanctimonious, Jack because Jack's just an asshole. But Simon having his mental breakdown, I tend to like mental breakdowns as well, was really fascinating to me. And the scene with the pig head on the stick, the fact that it went there, it built up to this moment where you have Simon developing his psychosis, I guess, in ways, while these kids are getting more and more murderous. And to have those two things dovetail to the head on the stick and the flies over the pig head, it was such a terrifying image. And I was loving every second of it. And the conversation Simon has with it, amazing. Amazing. And I kept wondering if we were going to get where Lord of the Flies came from, right? And to finally have that scene and that moment and the title appear, powerful. Titles appearing in books and movies can be really powerful to have those built up to like that. So I was a big fan. And, you know, I don't know if I would have been as into the book if I read it in high school, because my hometown, Canal Fulton, Ohio, small, 5,000 people, nobody was really that big of a dick. Like, I didn't think, I wouldn't have imagined kids could be this cruel. Everybody was kind of just like young, dumb, stupid, but not really mean to each other. By the time I got to high school, there were absolutely some people where you're like, oh, he has anger issues and is very violent. I don't want to be around this person at all. But in grade school, middle school, not so much. But I lived in Australia for a year, funny enough. And I would see these middle school, like grade school kids on the bus, and they were the most terrifying things in all of Australia. I know people are scared of like the poisonous snakes and spiders and cassowaries that gut you with their long claws, but you know, middle schoolers and grade schoolers in Australia were some vicious people. Like there was a kid, I worked at Subway, right? And there was a kid that would come in and just hold, like he'd reuse the same fountain drink cup and just keep getting free refills and run to Coogee Beach and then run back and get a free refill. And he and his friends were doing this. And a few of my coworkers were getting really annoyed by it and trying to stop them and yelling at them. I just asked them not to get me in trouble, and they tended to be cool with me. But I guess one kid came in there that my coworker had been yelling at, and he walks up, stands there, and he's shirtless. And the girl looks at him and she's like, oh, you're back. Like, get out of here. What do you want? He has a lighter, and he takes the lighter and flicks it on and starts burning his chest with it while making direct eye contact with her. Are you kidding me? And she said that she started crying because she didn't know what else to do. And the kid laughed and left and never came back. But like, Jesus. I was on the bus one time, and this 10-year-old kid and his friends see this girl who had to be like, I don't know, early 20s. And they're just like, oh, look at that bitch. That bitch is fine. Like, excuse me? Like, what are you? You're 10. What is that? And he walks up to her. This kid walks up to her and goes, hey, bird. Because they would call some girls birds. Can I get your number? Like, 10-year-old asking this 20-year-old for a number. Friends are all giggling. And she's like, no. I'm like, what? No. And he goes, ah, fine, you bitch. And walks away. Like, what? What are these kids doing? I was so scared to ride the bus at 2 to 4 in the afternoon in case middle school kids were on the bus or grade school kids were on the bus. I just didn't want to see Australian school children. All were terrifying. So it was after that experience, I think, that prepared me for Lord of the Flies a lot more. But I really do appreciate how Lord of the Flies was trying to deconstruct the archetypes of the psyche and where humanity can go in a given situation. Even though this is an island and what an extreme situation that these kids are in, I think it speaks to how people can reach points of justifying behavior and really getting swept up in mob mentality in any kind of social dynamic that isn't getting room to breathe or that is feeling very claustrophobic, which is kind of scary right now, given the coronavirus pandemic and everybody being stuck inside. Not that people are going to go full Lord of the Flies, but it's just those kinds of situations where things escalate without you really knowing how, why, when they got out of hand, but you just start getting swept up in the moment of everything. That's very human. Whether it ever reaches the insane points that it reaches in Lord of the Flies, it's still something that all of us will all of us will go through at some point in time where you just look back on it and you're like, what were we thinking? How did we reach that stage of thinking any of that was okay? My God. And for it to end how it ends, like we're so caught up in whether or not Ralph is going to survive being chased like a pig. are these kids going to impale him with the stick and treat him like a pig? Oh my God. To then run into adults and have adults arrive on the scene, and that sense of relief and that sense of an immediate like, oh my God, all this stuff really happened and there's no getting away from the consequences of what we did here. There's so much weight that falls upon the characters in that moment and falls upon us, the reader, as we're brought back out of the island's reality and into the actual world of everything. Ooh, that's crazy. And just getting at the idea of those constructs of worlds and the attitude we have in one world crashing suddenly into the attitude we know we're supposed to have in another world, that's really powerful as well. And the fact that there's that last little moment where the people that find the kids are in the Navy, they are, I guess, representative in some way, if you want to make that argument, of adults maybe aren't doing that much better in terms of things. Like, they're going to chastise these kids and be like, how could these kids reach this point of crazy behavior? But the irony is that the adults are also doing crazy things all the time, like war. Ugh. So there's some larger social commentary going on in this book as well that I still think is beautiful and great. And the thing that really pissed me off while I was reading the book was just thinking about Lost, because I started watching Lost from the first episode when it started airing, like 2004, I think it was, and being like, oh my God, this show's amazing. This show's so original. What an idea. You have these people on an island after a plane crash. They don't know what they're doing, and they're forming their own society, and there's the others, and they're the people that are normal, and they're fighting, and there's a smoke monster. Wow. And then I read Lord of the Flies 15 years later, and just like, oh shit. Oh, Lost just took everything from Lord of the Flies. Like, so much stuff from Lord of the Flies that it is kind of makes me hate Lost. Okay, maybe not hate Lost. I have other reasons for hating Lost. If you listen to the Watchmen HBO episode of this podcast, you'll hear me rant about Damon Lindelof's work just a little bit. But it really made me think less of Lost now that I've read Lord of the Flies. So that was a plus and a minus of the book. If you have read it before, I hope that maybe you'll give it another chance and read it again from the literature perspective and maybe get some more out of it now that you aren't forced to read it in high school. If you've never read it before and listened to this whole episode, I am amazed by you. Thank you. And you should go read Lord of the Flies and let me know what you think. If you have any thoughts about the book, want to share your experiences with it, have any questions you want me to answer, go ahead and leave comments on the YouTube video or hit me up at NewSchoolChris on Twitter or at Kanye Podcast on Twitter, as well as NewSchoolChris@gmail.com for the email. You can also leave requests for things you want me to talk about, books, movies, TV shows, and albums. And if you want to support the channel, the easiest way to do that, if you're on YouTube, leave a comment, like, or subscribe. Those three things tell YouTube that this is a channel that people value, so then it shows it to more people. And then we have to get to 1,000 subscribers to monetize, so every subscriber helps. If you're listening on the podcast formats, then just rating it on Apple really goes a long way to helping us get onto the charts, the top 200 art podcasts. That's my goal currently for the show. So I'd appreciate any and all help, but you know, at the end, thank you for listening and sharing your time. So until next time, my name's Chris, and this has been Chris.